Okay. So why did I want to start with the Heart Sutra? Why did I want to start with the Heart Sutra? And why did I want to start on Easter Sunday with the Heart Sutra? I mean, there was some conversation that we had about, do we really want to meet on Easter Sunday? People will have a lot of different things going on and whatnot. But I thought, well, you know, I mean, all over the world, people are into their idea of what Easter is, whatever their idea is of what Easter is. My idea, of course, of what Easter is different than what most Christians' idea is of what Easter is. But that doesn't make any difference. There's this kind of collective human thing going on right now about new beginnings and about hopefulness and about rebirth. And, I mean, we know it's a pagan event with a Christian shell over it. You know, it's spring and eggs are a good pagan symbol for God and rebirth and goddess and rebirth and all that kind of good stuff. So it seemed like a good time to do things. Why the Heart Sutra, though? Well, if you've been listening to some of my earlier recordings, or if you've come to some of the talks I've done over the last 5 years now, you know, I've talked a lot about the three principal aspects of the path, which is this very pithy Tibetan teaching about the essential element in Buddhist thought and practice. The three principal aspects of the path are, it was a text that was written by Tsongkhapa, who's one of the major Tibetan teachers, and I mean the lineage of the Dalai Lamas, for example, comes from this person, Tsongkhapa. But the text basically is 14 stanzas that compresses in those 14 stanzas everything you need to know about Buddhism. So that's great. 14 stanzas, four lines to each stanza, that's pretty good, right? But of course, as with many things, the more tightly you weave it, the harder it is to see through it, right? The harder it is to understand it. But the three aspects are, the first aspect is understanding about the nature of the world, and is it really going to work for you in the way you think it's going to, in terms of making you happy or satisfied or something like that? And the general Buddhist answer is it's probably not. Not that there's anything wrong with the world, but more about how do you approach the world is the problem. And the second aspect of the path is altruism, which is understanding a different way of humans and other beings relating to each other than the usual egocentric, you know, I'm going to get mine and to hell with you approach to life. But it's much more of an approach of there is actually great abundance, and the more we relate to that idea of sharing and equality and everybody getting what they need, actually the more there is rather than the less there is. It's kind of the inverse of the usual way of understanding things, which is kind of typical of Buddhism. The third aspect of the path is usually called wisdom, which is direct insight or direct seeing into the truth of what's really going on around here, apart from the way we're socially programmed or cognitively structured or the way our language would have us look at things, but directly really seeing and understanding what's happening. And so that's what's called wisdom in the Buddhist tradition. And in fact, if you think about it, the reason it's called the three principal aspects of the path is because in a fundamental way, that's just three ways of talking about the same thing. You know, I mean, if you're uncompassionate, you can't see reality. If you're unwise, you can't be compassionate. And you can't really have a sense of what's going on in the world if you're both unwise and uncompassionate, because then everything ends up being inverted. Anyhow, that's the Buddhist view of things. So perfection of wisdom means the perfect way of understanding what's really going on. And it's a way of cultivating our cognition. Because in every religion that I'm aware of, I mean, I think most of you know that I'm a professor of world religions. In every religion that I know of, except maybe for some of the most archaic religions, there's this idea that there's something wrong about the way we relate to our lives in the world, and that religion has something to do with getting it right and getting it sorted out and getting it straight. I mean, and Easter relates to that, or maybe Good Friday relates to that, so I'm not going to go kind of down the Christian thing about that. We know sort of the Christian views of what's wrong and what could be right and what needs to be done about it because we come from that culture. But the Buddhist view is that the main problem is a cognitive problem. The main problem is something about not understanding what's really going on here because of certain fundamental attitudes we have and certain fundamental ways of looking at things, and that brings about our own unhappiness. And if we could look at things in such a way as we could see what was really going on, we'd be happy. And actually, that's the whole point of it all. Sometimes Buddhism talks about liberation or enlightenment. And those things are real, and they're kind of unique to Buddhist thought. But the fundamental idea is, how do we get to be happy instead of being unhappy? How do we get to have lives that are satisfactory instead of lives that are unsatisfactory? How do we get to have lives that work for us instead of lives that sort of work for us and sort of don't work for us? And, you know, that can mean a lot of different things. I mean, for example, for myself, I have a big issue with, I get frustrated when things don't work out, and then I kind of get neurotic and angry and spin out of control and get bugged, and it makes me pretty unhappy. So the Buddhist view would be there's something wrong with the way I'm seeing things, and if I could get that straight, it would make me happier. Okay. So wisdom is about seeing it and getting it straight. And the perfection of wisdom is just that, the clarity, the perfect clarity to see what's going on. So the Buddhists had lots of ways of talking about this and lots of scriptures for talking about it. The Heart Sutra is one of the pithiest, tightest ways of talking about it. And on the website for the center, I put some resources up for the Heart Sutra. Some of those things I'll pass around for you to read tonight, but I'd like you to give them back to us so I can pass them out again in 2 weeks. But you can download a copy of everything that's on there and print it off yourself. Most things are only a page or two long. There's also an article there by a professor at Indiana University called Jan Natier, who wrote about the history of the Heart Sutra and explained why it is that it looks different if you translate it from the Chinese or if you translate it from the Sanskrit. Because it turns out that the original teachings started in India, and then a very long tome, 25,000 stanzas, 25,000 line version of the Heart Sutra, made its way to China a couple thousand years ago. And the Chinese, being very efficient, plucked out one little section of it and said, this is the essence of this particular long thing, and were particularly interested in it. And they chanted it, and they memorized it because that was the essence of the whole thing. They said, forget the 25,000 lines. Here we've got, you know, 30 lines. That's all you need to know. Forget the other 24,970. It's in the 30. And a Chinese pilgrim actually brought that piece of the text back to India about probably 1,400 years ago. And he settled at a great monastic university in near Bodh Gaya, actually, called Nalanda University. And they looked at what he had and said, hey, that's pretty cool, that's great. And so they translated it from Chinese back into Sanskrit. And so, of course, now it's gone from Sanskrit to Chinese and Chinese to Sanskrit. And then the Tibetans got it, and they translated it into Tibetan. Now we've gotten it, we've translated it into English. So you know the telephone game that kids play, you know? after a number of steps, it starts sounding a little bit different. But in this case, the meaning is the same, but of all the different versions, but they sound a little different. And so what's interesting about this is if you want to actually study the text, the translations from the Tibetan are best. And so that's what we'll do. We'll spend some time studying it, and I'll work through it with you all chunk by chunk by chunk. But if you want to chant it, the version that comes from the Chinese via Zen into English is the best. So we have a translation of the Heart Sutra that's chanted at San Francisco Zen Center. And so for those of us who want to do the chanting, Kay will show us how to do the chant. And then we'll do the chanting from that version. So we'll study one version, but we'll chant another version, which will seem discordant. But But we're all intelligent people, right? And one of the things that we can do is we can look at two versions and say, oh, that's like binocular vision. We get a new perspective on things, which is like depth. We can see even a little bit more deeply into what's going on in this teaching by looking at these different translations and these different translation sources. So sometimes I'll do that with us. But I do want to avoid confusion because it's hard enough material in itself. But still, we can do that and we can talk about it. It'll make for some interesting conversation, I think. So I'll share all of that stuff with you shortly. Within the Heart Sutra, there is a mantra. And for those of us who are in Yakima and receive the initiation and the perfection of wisdom, the goddess of perfect wisdom, the mantra that's associated with the goddess of perfect wisdom is Gate Gate Paragate Parasamgate Bodhi Svaha, and that is embedded in the Heart Sutra. That's where it comes from. So studying the Heart Sutra is really studying the meaning of the mantra that's embedded in the Heart Sutra. So it's not just that the 30 lines are the pithiest version of the wisdom teachings, but the mantra is the pithiest version of the 30 lines in one line. So, and the pithiest version of that, as Rinpoche said in Yakima, is Om. Right. Om. Om. So there you have it. Okay. Pithy on pithy on pithy. So the first thing is, here is a copy of the Tibetan version of the Heart Sutra, so why doesn't everybody take one? And then I'm going to pass around a copy of the chant, mostly because Kay will be having you chant it if you wish later, but I'm not probably going to talk about it myself tonight.
You're just going to end
around one? Did I? Oh, yeah. Oh, that wasn't very... I got it backwards.
I just kind of like try to memorize no,
no,
passage.
No.
I don't think that would happen.
It's my creeping dyslexic something or other that I put one thing in. Never mind, you got the picture.
Right.
I handed
it's
out the...
Cue.
Yeah, right. Oh, well.
From the peanut gallery.
Yeah, well, it's on. Fortunately, we all understand these things. Our arms aren't long enough to hold them out and read it, or our minds are sort of whatever they are. So, the text that I'll suggest that we use, or the textbook, if you will, that I'll suggest we use for study of this, I've also listed on the center website, along with a link to Amazon, if you like that sort of thing. And it's called Essence of the Heart Sutra, the Dalai Lama's Heart of Wisdom Teachings. But as I said, it's all online, along with a link to Amazon. And there's a paperback version of it, which is relatively cheap. So if you actually want to study the sutra and have a great commentary on it, there's hardly anybody that could be a better commentator on the Heart Sutra than the Dalai Lama. He, when he does his public teachings on when he does his public teachings on anything that fits within the wisdom tradition of Buddhism, he'll chant the Heart Sutra with the audience in advance of the teachings. And one of the things that he really likes to do to demonstrate the way in which the Heart Sutra is important across all kinds of different traditions is if he's doing teachings where there's a large audience, generally the nuns and the monks will sit up on the stage with him. And you'll have the nuns on one side and the monks on the other side. That's traditionally Buddhist. But the Vietnamese nuns will tend to sit together, and the Chinese nuns will sit together, and the Japanese nuns will sit together, and the Tibetan nuns will sit together, and the same with the monks. And he'll say, okay, let's chant this, and I'd like to hear the Vietnamese chant this. I would like to hear the Chinese chant this. I would like to hear the Japanese chant this. Now let's hear the chant in Sanskrit. Now we'll do the chant in Tibetan. And now we'll do it in English. And it's a way of sort of embracing all the different cultures and traditions that have become Buddhist. So it's actually really charming. And for myself, I found that the most beautiful chanting, for my taste, is when the Vietnamese nuns have chanted the Heart Sutra. It's really It's really wonderful. It's so sweet. And maybe you can track that down on the internet. Anyway, so that's what we'll use for commentary. And beyond that, what I'll say this evening is not a lot, but the very first line is, "Thus have I once heard. The Blessed One was staying in Rajgir at Vulture Peak, along with a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. And at that time, the Blessed One entered the meditative absorption on the varieties of phenomena called the appearance of the profound." So we could spend a lot of time talking about everything that's packed into that line. But I'm only going to comment on two things. "Thus have I once heard" is the standard way that the scriptures identify that something is a teaching of the Buddha. So the teachings of the Buddha are usually called sutras, and it's related to the word suture, which is interesting. That's something else we could talk about for a long time. But because Sanskrit and English are related to each other, Indo-European languages. But authentic teachings of the Buddha are identified by, through immemorial tradition, by a statement that says, at one time the Buddha was in such and such a place and I heard him say such and such a thing. And so the standard way of identifying a Buddha scripture is, thus I have heard at one time the Buddha was staying such and such a place and said such and such a thing. And so here it says, the Blessed One was staying at Rajgir at Vulture Peak. And Vulture Peak is this very interesting mountain not too far from Bodh Gaya in what's now northeastern India. And it simply refers to the fact that a lot of vultures hung out up there, I think. It doesn't particularly look like a vulture cane. I have been there. I didn't notice it looking like a vulture, and the vultures are long since gone. But there, it's not too far from places where the Buddha spent a lot of time, and so a lot of teachings of the Buddha were given in that particular location, including this one. Rajgir is like a county or a region or something like that. What's interesting is this term, the Blessed One, or the Blessed One. And in Sanskrit, that's called Bhagavan. And His Holiness has this very interesting comment about what this means. And I'm going to read this for the sake of people who are listening to this recording but aren't here. His Holiness talks about the origin of the teachings. It's that section, and he talks about this statement. And then he goes on and says this. The Bhagavan, that means the Blessed One, has totally transcended all obstructive forces, or we might say obscurations, to his mind, and is free from all the effects and limitations caused by these obstructive forces. All the factors obscuring true vision have been removed. We say that the obstructions are removed rather than that a new kind of vision is attained, because cognition has the natural capacity to understand or to know. And once there are no longer obstructive forces impeding its full function, its natural capacity to know becomes fully apparent. This state of clarity is the all-knowing state, the omniscient mind. In fact, one of the principal characteristics of the Buddha's omniscient mind is that it perceives both the relative and the ultimate truth simultaneously within a single cognitive event. Whereas, although beings who are not fully awakened may have some insight into the ultimate and relative, they must shift between the two perspectives. So that's the whole paragraph. But the essential piece of this paragraph, and the part that I wanted to share with you, and that I would like to talk with you about, is simply this. Everyone's mind has the capacity to know. We all know that, because we know. That's the essential thing about what our minds do. But Buddhism is about removing the obscuring elements of knowledge, but not adding anything to what we already have. you know, we think of, like, we go to school and we learn things, which means we accumulate knowledge and we learn new techniques. And we learn, we get skills at insight and so on and so forth. College is like accumulating stuff. So I know this from the classes that I teach. Besides the fact that basically what the students say is, what do I need to know for the exam, which is mostly what they want to know, if they walk into a class and then they walk out of it and they don't feel like they got something poured into their heads somehow, then they don't feel like they got anything from the educational experience. And so we're sort of trained to think about learning stuff as gaining. Everything in Buddhism is about removing. Everything in Buddhism about learning is about getting rid of the wrong stuff. You don't even have to acquire the right stuff, although that might be useful in some ways because they're antidotes to the wrong stuff. But the most important thing is getting rid of the obscuring factors, the wrong ideas, the bad habits that kind of cover your natural wisdom, your natural capacity to see what's going on, the natural clarity that's already there within you. It's there. It's just you don't know it because it's covered up. So Buddhism is about removing the coverings. So it's actually very hard to teach about Buddhism, right? Because how do you teach people about removing stuff? There's no natural inclination to do that. But that's what the deal is. It's about removing.